Thank you. Be seated. Justices Cook and Doggett are recused in this case. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Page versus Jesser.
May it please the court, Mr. John J. G. Adamy Jr. will present argument for petitioners. He has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. This is an oil and gas case involving the execution of work orders and invoices while operations were being conducted on this well, which contain indemnity provisions and exculpatory provisions, which are sought to be applied to petitioners in this case, so as to avoid the consequences of the negligence of the respondents, Dresser and Houston Fishing Tools. There are three primary points before this court on which this court has granted this writ. They are particularly important in that the primary question, the first question, which is point three, relates to whether or not this court will apply the same standards concerning strict construction of contracts and concerning the fair notice provisions of conspicuousness and express negligence to exculpatory provisions as it has in the past imposed upon provisions related to indemnity. It's our position that if the legal effect of any of the terms of the contract transfers the risk of loss or liability for one's own negligence to another contracting party and frees the actor from liability for his own negligence, then such provisions are to be strictly construed and expressly subject to the fair notice and clearly conspicuous provisions that this court has heretofore imposed upon indemnity provisions. It is our position that whether you call a provision a release or a limitation of liability or any other term or designation, if its purpose is to transfer the risk of loss to another party and free that actor from negligence, then all such provisions should be subjected to the same requirements, and there should be no different standard for an indemnity provision as opposed to an exculpatory provision.
Should the requirement that they be conspicuous be the same for all contracting parties?
Yes, Your Honor, it should.
Regardless of whether it's not necessarily in this case, but a consumer transaction, more or less a contract of adhesion as opposed to a contract negotiated between parties?
Certainly a contract of adhesion where there is an imbalance of bargaining authority, that would even be more of a basis and reason that the provisions be conspicuous, particularly when those contracts of adhesion and those terms of adhesion and the terms that actually transfer the risk of the risk of loss and the risk of liability or on the reverse side of the document. There should be something notable of notice and distinctive that alerts that individual to that type of an agreement.
Mr. Adamy, let's assume for the sake of discussion.
Yes, sir.
That the court were to impose the same requirements of the express negligence rule as we have on indemnity agreements to releases. And the question then becomes, is conspicuousness a question of fact or a question of law?
Conspicuousness is a question of law, particularly when that question is to be determined from the document itself. In this particular case, that determination was made from the document itself. And on all such questions, whenever the primary thrust of the term is to shift the liability and to shift the risk of loss to another person who is not negligent, then it is our position that yes, under those circumstances, that is a question of law to be gleaned from the document itself. Basically, there is no sound reason for there to be any different standard for one or the other, because the effect of the terms is the same. And the effect is to place that contracting party in a position where that party must assume the acts and liability of another person.
Mr. Adam, are you familiar with the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company versus Jefferson Construction Company?
Yes, sir, I am.
Well, how can you distinguish that case from the argument you just made? Because in that case, it appears that the court found that there was some evidence of conspicuousness, indicating perhaps it would be a jury question.
In that particular case, Your Honor, the court made a clear distinction between actual notice or knowledge and fair notice from the document. Now, if there is a situation where there is actual notice or actual knowledge, not involved in the document itself, but the notice of the parties, for instance, as to perhaps the terms or provisions that may be reviewed, then in those instances, the Goodyear case said notice in that case is a fact question, but that relates to actual notice, actual knowledge. Fair notice from the document is a question of law. So that when you have a situation where you have, for instance, the question of whether was there actual notice, then that would be a jury issue. But in reviewing the Goodyear case, I noticed that specifically in that one paragraph where it was talking about notice is a jury question. If the court will review that provision, that specifically relates to actual notice. And that is the distinction. That was not an issue in this case. There was no evidence of any knowledge. In fact, all evidence was to the contrary. And in connection with the document itself, the court construed the document strictly from its terms.
What does the evidence show of the course of dealings between the parties?
This was their first course of dealings, as I understood, their first agreement.
Now, while this provision does not stand out, it's not hidden either. And there are not a lot of words on the back, as there are in some form contracts, pretty easy to see.
There are many factors, Your Honor, that I believe need to be considered as to whether you call it hidden. The distinction of the type, whether the type is different or set apart from other type, whether it's a contrasting color. In the Goodyear case, for instance, in that particular case, the notice pertaining to the terms and conditions that were to be imposed upon the parties was in bold, larger, red type. And not like this particular contract at all. This particular contract or the contracts that are in issue before this court are very similar to the K&S well service contracts. That case did not reach this court, but it's a court of appeals case where the provisions are very, very similar. In this particular case, of course, the court held as a matter of law that the provisions were not conspicuous and therefore unenforceable.
Should there be some distinction based upon the sophistication of the parties? If this were an ordinary consumer contract, we might take one view of conspicuousness, but don't businessmen have to read their contracts?
Yes, sir, businessmen do have to read their contracts, but in the oil field, and this was evidence before the court, these are labeled as invoices. These are labeled as work orders, and oftentimes serve as a strictly a receipt of services rendered and are not even intended for purposes of any contractual obligations. Another situation is you may have a representative out there who has no authority whatsoever to bind his principal. Now, in this particular case, there was an issue on that, and that issue was answered to contrary to our position. But in the situation where, as in this case, that particular evidence before the court in this case was that he didn't know the terms. The terms are different. Houston Fishing Tool's own president said he didn't from one week to the other know what the terms on the reverse side were.
Could you explain who Mr. McCumber and Mr. Wallace?
Yes, sir, I will. Mr. McCumber signed the work order as a representative of Page Petroleum. Mr. Wallace signed the work order as a representative of Houston Fishing Tools.
And what type of authority did those gentlemen have for their respective employers?
Mr. McCumber was employed by the operator. And he was an employee of the operator who was, in effect, not employed by a Page, but was an independent contractor. So Mr. McCumber was the representative of the operator on the well site.
Do I understand you to say that the evidence shows that this so-called work order was filled out by these parties after they described the job and then they tack on these terms and conditions as part of the work order? Are they negotiated? Are they discussed? Do they get legal counsel as to what terms and conditions are going to be in the work order? Or is this just part of all work orders?
Those terms are not discussed at all. In effect, oftentimes the evidence would show, and in this particular case, they arrive at the work site and they sign the document, and in effect, that's all that's stated. In this particular case, there was no discussion about the terms whatsoever.
However, you know, you don't go into it blind because in the very front page it says, see the terms and conditions on the bind.
I understand, sir.
All right, so there was no attempt to hide the terms and conditions. There may have been no discussion, but certainly there was no attempt to hide them because in the front page it says, you better look at the back page.
There was no attempt to deceive. That is correct. The question is whether or not there is a conspicuous enough, whether or not these terms and conditions are conspicuous enough in order to put a person on notice that by signing this document, he may be assuming the negligence of some other party.
They've been on the front page right above the signature. That been enough?
If it would have been in bold red type.
Well, but if it had been black type instead of red, that been enough?
If it would have been black and larger, as I think that might, something distinctive.
But the same size, front page, right above his signature.
Same size, even perhaps even smaller than the other print.
No, it was the same size.
Okay, same size.
The only way you could miss it was just to scribble your name on it and hand it back.
Same size, there's nothing distinctive. That would not, in my judgment, be sufficient.
Mr. Adamy, what difference does it make if it's conspicuous or not if there's actual notice? Why shouldn't that be the key?
Well,
and if authority of the party to bind the...
If there's actual notice, then in that situation, I believe that would alleviate the requirement for conspicuousness.
Because it's kind of hard for this court to write an opinion that these sorts of agreements have to be in such size type and on the front page above the signature line or on the back. That's something the legislature does
right.
from time to time, but isn't the key actual notice? I mean, wouldn't that solve this problem?
It would have. It may have solved this problem, but that was not what happened. There was no notice.
I understand, but realizing this court's got to write something that's going to apply to a lot of cases in addition to this one, wouldn't that be the key?
That would be the key. If they had actual notice, then the requirements for conspicuousness, I think, would fall by the wayside. But in this, where there is no actual notice and the conspicuousness requirement is not satisfied from the form of the document, and you do have those type provisions, then I think in that instance, based on prior decisions by this court would be required to write that they would have to uphold the conspicuousness requirements.
Mr. Adamy, I'm not as familiar with the record as perhaps I should, but what were the allegations of the parties with regards to this issue of actual notice? Did Dresser and Houston Fish and Tools plead that your clients were on actual notice of these terms and provisions, and were there any issues submitted to the jury on this question?
No, sir.
No, as to both? They did not plead and defend this case on the basis that you had actual notice?
I don't recall any pleadings as to actual notice, and there was no issue on actual notice.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Dresser.
May it please the court, Mr. Kinsey Feldman and Ms. Jennifer Brooke Hogan will present arguments for respondents. Ms. Brooke Hogan will open and will speak for 13 minutes.
May it please the court, I am Jennifer Hogan and I represent Houston Fishing Tools, one of the respondents in this case. Let me begin with your question at the end, Judge Gonzalez, about the issue of actual notice. Let me tell you that the way that this case arose, I don't want there to be any confusion, is that Page and others, who we will refer to collectively as Page, sued HFT and Dresser and others as a defense. HFT and Dresser both raised their contracts that existed and said that these contracts exonerated them from liability due to the exculpatory provisions that existed. So HFT and Dresser pled their affirmative defense to this negligence action as the contract. In response to our contract claim, it was Page's obligation to plead any possible excuse or confession and avoidance that it was not to be bound by the contract. And they did plead a few matters of confession and avoidance. The only things that they pled in terms of confession and avoidance were a lack of authority by the people who signed this contract, particularly in B.F. McCumber, who signed the HFT invoice, and that the statute that these contracts were void as a matter of public policy and by statute in Texas. Those are the only matters of confession and avoidance that were pleaded. Now, if we are to get to lack of authority, as you suggest, Judge Cornyn, it is our position that it is Page's burden to have pleaded a lack of authority or a lack of actual knowledge, in order to defeat the terms of this contract. That it is Page's responsibility to have pleaded a lack of intent to be bound. It is their matter of confession and avoidance. It's very similar to this court's Mercer versus Wood discovery rule discussion. I mean, it's the same sort of principle here. We have pled a contract. It is their duty to respond to that contract and plead matters of confession and avoidance. They did not plead a lack of actual notice, and they did not request any issue on a lack of actual notice. They requested a fact-finding after the conclusion of this jury trial as to actual notice, but that is obviously an independent ground of recovery or defense, and so they cannot simply achieve the result by asking for treating it as some omitted element. As to a lack of intent, they did not plead any lack of intent. Page suggests in this court that they requested an issue on lack of intent. There is no requested issue in this record, however. None exists, and there is no ruling by the trial court on any requested issue, a denial of any requested issue on intent. And if you will look at the pages in the record that Page cites you to, where they claim to have said that they requested a special issue on intent, what that specifically says is that plaintiffs accept and object to the court's charge and the failure of the court's charge to include the requested special issues as submitted by plaintiffs in connection with the submission of this charge, and in particular, such special issue as to whether or not Ben McCumber agreed to the terms and conditions of the Houston work order. I would suggest to you that even if this court wanted to believe that this statement is somehow enough to preserve error, there is nothing in this statement that suggests that a question was tendered regarding intent, and it certainly would not be the intent of Ben McCumber to agree to these terms and conditions. It is a question of intent of Page to agree to the terms and conditions. On the question of conspicuousness, first, as this court recognized just last week in Getty, this court and no other court in Texas has ever extended the doctrine of express negligence, or for that matter, the doctrine of conspicuousness, although it was not an issue in Getty, to anything but an indemnity provision.
Why shouldn't we extend it? If you'd accept Justice Vance's argument and his concurrent dissenting opinion, he can find no public policy reasons why we ought to treat indemnity contracts and releases any different. Can you suggest some public policy reasons perhaps that Justice Vance could not come up with?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. I do not agree with Justice Vance's description of what these provisions are. I mean, I think that indemnity provisions and exculpatory provisions are extremely different, and the public policies that exist for requiring indemnity provisions to be treated to meet an express negligence test, for example, don't exist with regard to exculpatory provisions. Exculpatory provisions are between the two contracting parties that are the only people who they affect. In our case, and anytime you have a case that's between two corporations, we are talking about a property damage case. Property damage, which both parties are completely able to assess the risk of loss that exists. It does not involve third parties, claims from outsiders for which the risk cannot be assessed in advance and which you cannot determine what kind of liability coverage you're going to need. We're not even talking about a suit by one of Page's employees, which would be an indemnity obligation is the only way it could arise. We're talking only and solely about a claim by Page as to the work that was performed by HFT and by Dresser. When only the contracting parties are involved, there's no problem in risk shifting or opening up enormous liability, which the parties have no way to foresee. Exculpatory clauses extinguish litigation.
But this is a type of risk shifting.
Certainly, Your Honor. Just as in Getty, we're talking about a type of risk-shifting provision. There are all kinds of risk-shifting provisions in contracts. That's what contracts are. If you take a look at the terms and conditions on this work order, if you read every one of these terms and conditions, every one of those terms and conditions is a risk-shifting provision. If all risk-shifting provisions are to be in bold, capital, red letters, every one of these provisions has to be in bold, capital, red letters. And if we view conspicuousness then in a vacuum, then none of these provisions is going to be conspicuous. But every one of these is a risk-shifting provision. That's the purpose of contract. In virtually all of the cases where this court and the other courts of Texas have dealt with exculpatory provisions in the past, they arise in all sorts of situations, and they involve all sorts of limitations of liability. We're talking about apartment leases. We're talking about HL&P's contracts with its customers. We're talking about, in cases like Whitson and Winkler, where we're talking about contracts that individuals enter into with fitness companies or with medical so-called medical companies. We're talking about apartment leases between landlords and tenants. All of those have risk shifting and liability protecting, liability limiting provisions.
But what if we just narrow the scope, as Justice Vance has done in his opinion, and only focus on the risk shifting that deals with one's own negligence to another party, and forget about all how complicated is that?
I think it still encompasses all of those cases that I've just talked about, Judge Gonzalez, because they are all that. I mean, they are all exculpatory provisions which exempt one of the contracting parties from any liability to the other contracting party.
At worst, doesn't that just mean that the price for the services rendered will also include the price of insurance premiums that can be used to protect the party that contractually agrees to the indemnification?
Certainly, Your Honor, and I think that's what happens in this case and in every case where they exist out there. I mean, to suggest that there was no notice or that this is somehow an unusual occurrence in this industry is simply not supported by the record in this case. I mean, these parties go in. The chief operating officer of Page testified that he knew these kinds of terms and conditions were on the back of this purchase order, that he had read these. He didn't necessarily give much weight to them, he said, but he did have lawyers available to discuss the weight that should be given to them if he had chosen to. He recognized that all service contractors do come forward with these types of provisions. Page's own expert at trial testified that his fishing company, which was in the same business as HFT, used these same provisions and had to as a matter of business practice because they wouldn't want to be have to submit to the kinds of liability which existed, couldn't perform the services that they performed if they faced the liabilities that existed, and that's the reason why these provisions exist. And it is a matter of simply obtaining, I mean, we're talking about an insurance, obtaining insurance to cover a known risk, the value of this well, in a sense, in this particular case. And that's what happens in all of these cases. I mean, the risk is easily ascertained. Page retains the right to oversee its well. It can conduct, it can control the operations. There is evidence which goes both ways in this record about who had responsibilities for what kinds of things, but it is clear that Page certainly had the opportunity to control what went on at its well site and had the ability to control these workers if it did not in fact do so. And I would suggest to you that the record shows that it did in fact do so.
But doesn't the law in essence determine that it is counterintuitive that a contracting party should be responsible for someone else's fault? And if that's going to be the case, then you have to say so clearly that can't be avoided because you don't expect to find that provision in the agreement.
I would suggest, Your Honor, two things. First, in this industry practice, with these kinds of contracts, what this record tells you is that parties do expect and do know that these provisions are in contract.
Except isn't the fact that out of the oil patch there are all sorts of arguments about whether they do and whether they should, and that's what's giving rise to most of this kind of litigation.
I suppose that there's some, Judge Vance in his concurring and dissenting opinion wants to talk about what McCumber, the guy who signed that, he's not terribly well educated. Maybe he doesn't know anything to be able to sign these, and we don't know everything about what happened. In this case, the evidence is that this work order was presented to him before any work was done, that he was the man in charge, that he, for Page, that he had the authority to sign it and to bind Page. He knew he was signing it. He sent these things to Page the day they were signed or the next day. Page got them. So I think that in this circumstance, with this agreement, it all worked exactly as it was supposed to, except perhaps for the fact that Mr. McCumber didn't read it when he got it. But that's no basis for avoiding this contract. But let me just say, Judge, I don't think that you can get much clearer. And there has arisen some dispute. I thought we resolved this in the Court of Appeals. There's some dispute about which set of terms and conditions is on the back of the original work order. It's my understanding this court has the original work order, but I am trying to find it. Whichever one of these agreements we talk about, though, I think that this, we meet conspicuousness and we meet express negligence. We don't have a lot of stuff back here. If there's not anything that is in any way suggests that these terms are hidden, they all relate to what is that issue in this case, the exculpation. There's only four numbers up there and seven, a total of seven paragraphs. We expressly state that the liability that's referred to includes the sole or concurrent negligence of HFT. I mean, these provisions are just about as clear, straightforward, and as simple as you can get. And I think if we're going to reach conspicuousness, that these meet that test.
Your light has flashed. Are there any questions?
I do not wish to use up Mr. Colby's time. Thank you.
My name is Ken Sullivan. I'm here today for Dresser Industries. And it is no coincidence that Dresser Industries and Houston Fishing Tools are before this court on virtually identical contractual provisions. They are very common in the oil field, and they are very important to basic oil field economics. Virtually every service contractor has these because service contractors, as a practical matter, could not long survive if they were exposed to the type of unlimited liability that can be represented by the type of work that they engage in.
You say that, but as I think Judge Detect asked earlier, it's just merely a question of who pays the insurance premiums. And if the service contractors do, then presumably their price goes up. They charge more on that end, and the owner of the well pays more for service and pays less for direct insurance.
Your Honor, as a practical matter, I think that goes to some of the issues relative to Chapter 127 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code, in that there is, generally speaking, an inequality of power between oil companies and service contractors, and there is probably a very serious question as to whether some of the service contractors who are smaller in nature could effectively insure away that type of risk. But with respect to the issue of notice of the risk-shifting arrangement that had been agreed to by the parties here, Page's president conceded in his testimony that he was well aware that these were routine agreements in the oil field industry and that he anticipated service contractors to have them.
What were the jury, were there any jury findings as to your contract in this area? The knowledge of these parties or the customer?
Your Honor, the only finding I think that was relevant was one of authority that has been mentioned before. As a practical matter, though, Your Honor, as the Amoco Chemical versus Sutton case says, the question of notice is one that is certainly presumed when there's a signature in place, as there is here. I've blown up the relevant portion at the top of the front page of our service agreement, and as the court will note, immediately under the disclosure statement, there are terms and conditions on the back. There is the signature of the Page representative, and in fact, there are some other things. The Page representative has checked instrument protection. I mean, it is clear that in this case there was actual notice. The person in question signed it. He signed it immediately underneath the disclosure. There is the discussion that everyone anticipated this. That was discussed by Page's expert, by Page's own chief operating officer. I think there's no question at all that there was actual notice in this case. But the question of notice, once you have a signed agreement like this one, is one in which the burden is clearly on the party seeking to avoid the contract that it is signed. These were two commercial entities that had been engaged in a course of dealing over a period of time. That is, again, the chief operating officer of Page testified that they had used Dresser before and, in fact, specifically sought out Dresser in this case because they liked the work that Dresser did. So I don't think that there's any serious question that Page knew exactly what it was getting with respect to the contractual arrangement it had with Dresser. Although Dresser is in a virtually identical position to Houston Fishing Tools, I stand before the court representing a petitioner in this case, because the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, held that the parties somehow did not intend this agreement to protect Dresser from claims by its customer, Page. In order to do that, the Court of Appeals had to ignore the explicit language of the terms and conditions. That is, as the court will note some of the highlighted language, there are several references made explicitly to Page, Dresser's customer. It says explicitly that the customer shall hold us free and harmless, and that the provision includes any claims that may be caused by our negligence, that is Dresser's negligence, and whether such claims are made by the customer or the customer's employees or by third parties. So there are multiple references.
That just couldn't be right.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
The Court of Appeals said that just couldn't be right.
The Court of Appeals, inexplicably, I think, simply says that this is somehow surplusage and it should be ignored, even though there are multiple references to the intent of the parties to include Page and Page's claims. To justify this result, the Court of Appeals apparently took the position that this was only an indemnity provision and that somehow an indemnity provision could only apply to third parties. But that explicitly ignores the fact that there is hold harmless language and exculpatory language that's contained in the agreement. That was explicitly pleaded as an affirmative defense by Dresser to Page's claims. And it's very similar to some of the language contained in the Whitson v. Goodbody's case, which also references hold harmless language, just as this one does.
Do you think it makes any difference whether we characterize this as a release or as an indemnity agreement?
Your Honor, I think in terms of effect, it should not make any difference. I think it's a distinction without a difference.
I mean, not just in your contract, but as a general principle.
I think that there is no reason, either by way of definition or by way of public policy.
You disagree with Ms. Hogan on this regard?
In terms of the effect is the point that I was trying to make. I don't think we disagree on that point. I think some of the questions that have come up previously were in terms of conspicuousness and not in terms of the effect of the language that is negotiated between the two parties. I don't believe that there's any reason of policy or of definition as to why two parties can agree, either by an exculpatory agreement or by an indemnity agreement, to contract away the indemnitor's claims of negligence, or in a case like this one, Page's claims of negligence.
The problem is one of labels. If you label the agreement indemnity agreement, you have a whole body of law with regards to express negligence rule. If you label the agreement a release, you do not have to. You do not have to be burdened or have the onus of that law. You know, so that labels do make a difference.
I think the key distinction, Your Honor, to set aside the labeling issue, because I agree that would be just a question of form, is the question is whether there are third parties, particularly unknown third parties, to the agreement, specifically to an indemnity provision, so that one party may have a certain inequality of bargaining power in terms of trying to assess the risk and the complications that may be involved by those third parties. I think that's the reason that there's an express negligence standard and a somewhat higher standard that in some cases can apply to an indemnity provision. That doesn't apply in this case because this provision, under whatever label we use, and clearly there are both provisions, that is both an exculpatory and an indemnity provision contained in this particular paragraph. This provision, those sorts of concerns don't apply because there are none of those third parties that the court might otherwise be concerned about.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would like to address the first matters brought forward in connection with the pleadings that were before the court. All parties in this case well knew and well represented to the trial court that the question of conspicuousness and the construction of this document was a question of law. In our brief, we have cited numerous occasions, some 12, 15 locations, where both sides have stated that it is a question of law. Summary judgment and responses were filed. And it was our position that the document was not conspicuous. And that was clearly before the court. It was clearly before the court on motions for instructed verdict. It was clearly before the court on motions for judgment. And if, in fact, the pleadings, if their position is the pleadings do not involve the conspicuous requirement, certainly that was a question of law. It was before the court and tried by consent, express or implied.
Well, I understood the argument to be that actual notice is not a question of law, and you should have pleaded it and submitted it.
On that particular point, it certainly was not my issue. In connection with the document, if we're looking at the form, then that is the notice that we must look to. We must look to what notice is imparted from this document. If there's anything further, I had nothing further to present because there wasn't any actual notice. And I didn't have to show there wasn't any actual notice.
Mr. Adamy, you're the one that's trying to get from under the terms and conditions of the contract. You pled that the addresser of Houston Fishing Tools owed you some money. They said, we don't owe you a dime.
Yes, sir.
And the reason we don't owe you a dime is because the terms and conditions keep us from paying you any, being liable to you.
Correct.
At that juncture, according to Ms. Hogan's argument is, if you were going to try to get from under the terms and conditions of the contract that you signed, it was your responsibility to try to bring something to the court, bring a theory to the court under which you could escape out from these terms and conditions. And the only thing that was left to you was plead, argue, assert, prove lack of actual notice. So why, isn't that your issue?
No, sir, it's not, because my point was that from the standpoint of the document itself, as a matter of law, it was not conspicuous. Therefore, it was not going to be enforceable as to me.
So whether you had actual notice or not, actual notice is irrelevant.
The second thing...
Are you arguing that actual notice is irrelevant? As long as the terms and conditions are not conspicuous as a matter of law, no matter how much you knew, it doesn't matter.
What I did is I put on evidence of no notice. Mr. McCumber had no actual knowledge. I put on evidence of Wallace and Clendenin actually stated they didn't know what was on. They were the ones for Houston Fishing Tools. They didn't know what was on the back of these, precisely what was on the back of these work orders, and in fact said that if they showed the back of these work orders to individuals that they were doing services for, they would not be able to even do the service.
But the question is, focus on pay your clients.
Yes, sir.
And your clients' lack of knowledge.
My client had no knowledge of the terms and provisions of these documents. My client was not even on the site.
Well, you had an agent?
McCumber.
Your agent?
Was our agent, and he had no actual knowledge of the terms and conditions. That was in the record. So as a matter of law, the court could conclude, and I think did conclude, that there was not an issue of actual notice, and that as a matter of law, there was no actual notice by the parties of the terms and conditions. Therefore, we're held to the standard of what does a document say, and what are the requirements regarding conspicuousness from something that must be construed and interpreted from the form itself.
If the only provisions on the back had pertained to this problem of risk shifting, this particular problem.
Yes, sir.
If they had been the only ones on the back, would that be conspicuous?
Your Honor, I don't think that it would. I think that something must be distinctive on the front.
If they had been the only conditions on the front?
If they had been the only conditions on the front, like the InSearch case where you've got an indemnity provision and you have an exculpatory provision in the InSearch case.
These are two-thirds.
Right on the front.
These are two-thirds of all of the terms and conditions on the back.
Yes, sir.
The only other conditions relate to payment and loss of product.
Yes, sir.
Damage and loss of product.
That's correct.
But that, in your view, does not make them conspicuous.
they're not made conspicuous because there's nothing on the front side to alert the individual signing the document that he's signing a document which may create potential horrendous liability to him or to his principal.
There are references on the front.
Yes,
two,
sir.
Two separate references that go to the back.
That is
do
correct.
Do they need to be in bigger type, or do they need to say danger or warning, or both?
They don't need to say danger or warning. They need to be, as defined by the UCC for conspicuous, they need to be distinctive. Section 1.201, parentheses 10, regarding the definition of conspicuous. Something that sets them apart, larger type, bolder type, contrasting type. Something that sets the terms and provisions apart.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Yes, sir.
That concludes the arguments both of this morning's causes. The court expresses a welcome to Judge Spector, who's sitting on the back row, taking notes, I believe. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable Supreme Court.